I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Daryl D'Souza has resigned as the Baltimore City Police Commissioner after a brief tenure of only 4 months. WYPR's Dominique Maria Bonesi attended a press conference with Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh this morning. She'll bring us the latest news as the city begins a search for a new chief. Then, the human brain hasn't evolved in an optimal way, and that has deeply influenced everything we do and understand about being human. Johns Hopkins researcher and author David Linden joins me to talk about his new book, Think Tank, a collection of essays by 40 neuroscientists about the biological roots of human experience. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Soul, the Stax musical, at Baltimore Center Stage. That's all coming up when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest today is David Linden, a neuroscientist from Johns Hopkins. We're going to talk about a new collection of essays that he's compiled about our brains. But before we do that, Dominique Maria Bonesi joins us here in Studio A. She's got an update on the latest news regarding the resignation of Daryl D'Souza as the police commissioner of Baltimore City. And by the way, we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. So, Dominique, you were at a press conference with Mayor Catherine Pugh this morning. What'd she have to say?
So the mayor basically said she takes full responsibility for the selection of D'Souza and the hiring. And she says that was because she felt comfortable with him being a veteran on the force. And also she said that she really appreciated his drive and his motivation to really reduce the city's crime. So she basically applauded his 3 months, on the job as commissioner, and said this was his decision to resign, and that she accepted his resignation.
The Sun today had a piece that federal prosecutors who filed these charges against Mr. D'Souza for not paying his taxes for 3 years, they've also issued subpoenas to a grand jury. So it doesn't sound like this is the last we'll hear of Mr. D'Souza's situation.
This is not the last we're going to hear. They're asking for other documentation, like travel documents, personnel records, a secondary job income. So they're looking for secondary sources of income that might have gone underreported.
Is there have they made any announcement about how they're going to conduct the search for a new police chief? I mean, the mayor said yesterday, right after Mr. D'Souza resigned, that they were going to conduct a national search. Did they flesh that out at all?
Well, they will be using an outside agency, contracting out an agency to help with that search. And that's typical of a national search, that any national search that's done under the city. Also, we know that from what the city solicitor had to say today, that vetting process is going to be much higher now. We're seeing, he's saying we're going to get more documentation, making sure, asking that question, have you filed your taxes? And just asking more focused questions. When I asked for examples of those questions, I didn't get any examples. They said they wouldn't go into specifics quite yet.
That's Andre Davis, himself a former federal judge. So he and the Office of the Solicitor is now going to become involved in the search process for not just the police commissioner, but would they also then become involved in searches for high-level people throughout the administration?
Yeah, so any future high-level appointees of the mayor, those are all going to have to go through this vetting process. He says he's putting together his senior staff to help with that process. That originally was supposed to be the senior staff of the mayor's office having that responsibility.
Is there any thought that Mr. D'Souza's problems with his tax returns are not unique to Mr. D'Souza? Are they going to do a sweep or some sort of thing to determine whether anybody else in the department has similar problems?
Well, we know this. We've seen this. I mean, the Gun Trace Task Force trial, the federal trial that led to an officer being put in prison for 15 years. We have heard of abuse of overtime. The Baltimore Brew has done pieces about abuse of overtime. It is not unlikely that there are other officers in the force that could potentially have those same issues, because we've seen them before. It's kind of a cloud that's hanging over the Baltimore City Police Department right now.
Sure. And of course, this is all in the context of a consent decree with the Justice Department that's ongoing. One final quick thing. Gary Tuggle, who is the acting commissioner, speaking of the Baltimore Brew, they published a piece yesterday saying that he's submitted some incorrect information on his ethics form.
Right. It's saying that he had an address in Upper Marlboro, that's in Prince George's County, and right now, the mayor is saying that there is no problem with him living in Upper Marlboro as acting commissioner. She says that if he were to, you know, be selected for the job, he would have to move to Baltimore City. That's part of the requirements now for the job under Baltimore City laws. So we'll see.
Is he a candidate for the job?
We are not sure yet. I've been in touch with the Baltimore City Police Department. They've yet to get back to me. They say, I've talked to some people on the mayor's staff saying it's too soon to know whether or not he'll actually apply for that job.
All right. Well, Dominique Maria Banesi from the WIPR News Department, very grateful for your update. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
Have a good one. We turn now to David Linden. He's a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and the former editor of the Journal of Neurophysiology. The brain training industry, companies like Lumosity, CogMed, and NeuroNation, they promise everything from raising our IQs to keeping our aging brains sharp. This is a billion-dollar enterprise. David Linden writes books about our brains, and in his latest opus, he says the public is, quote, inundated by a fire hose of neuro-BS. Linden's first book, The Accidental Mind, explored how our brains evolved over time. It turns out that evolution was not an orderly affair. In a book called The Compass of Pleasure, he argues that we are hardwired to seek pleasure in a variety of forms. And in a book called Touch, he explored the ways in which touch is tied in one way or another to our emotions. He wrote his new book with more than three dozen fellow neuroscientists. It's called Think Tank. It's a collection of essays about our brains and the biological roots of human experience. The essays address questions like, how are children's brains different from those of adults? What can monkey brains teach us about advertising? And how do our brains process pain? David Linden joins me here in Studio A. And again, we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. It's good to see you again.
It's good to be back.
So I really enjoyed talking to you about all three of your other books and enjoyed this one as well. Let's talk about this inundation that you acknowledge by a fire hose of neuro-BS. Give us a couple of examples of the kind of BS you see out there in the general population.
Well, you know, people are really interested in the brain. They're really interested in human experience and emotion and all the ways in which our brain is central to connecting us to the world. And so there's a deep thirst for this, but not everything that's being provided is of good quality. So I have read stories, for example, claiming that having the color blue around you makes you more creative. I would say that falls into the category of neuro-BS. There have been claims that the brain activity of Democrats versus Republicans is fundamentally different and differentiable with a brain scanning machine. I would also call neuro-BS on that.
So these things like, you know, Sudoku and these brain games that people are selling and all of that kind of stuff, is there any merit to their efficacy?
Very little. The brain training games have rather delimited effects. In other words, you get much better at the game and at tasks that are very, very similar to the game, but they don't generalize. If you want to preserve and enhance your cognition, the single best thing you can do is physical exercise. The second best thing you can do is eat a heart-healthy diet. And the third best thing you can do is to engage in a range of cognitive pursuits that don't require for you to buy anyone's software.
Right. No software. Maybe just some actual discussions about stuff. Or
yes.
It's interesting. The premise of the book is that you got together with many of your colleagues in the neuroscience business, and you asked them to sort of pick the thing that they are particularly interested in to write about. So how did they come up with the topics they wanted to expound upon, and how did you organize it?
Well, so for years, after a few beers or other mildly mind-altering substances, I'd been asking my colleagues, not just here at Johns Hopkins, but around the world, this question: what would you most like to explain about the brain to a general audience? What are you burning to explain? And I've been impressed because people in that situation, the scientists don't lapse into the minutiae of their latest experiment in their lab and get all nerdy. They open their eyes and usually speak something very general and interesting and often counterintuitive. So obviously, I picked a range of people not randomly. I picked people to cover the breadth of a bunch of different topics. I didn't want 40 essays on vision, for example, or hearing or emotion. I wanted to spread it out. So I invited people with a range of interests. That said, people surprised me. Not everyone wrote about what they work on in their own laboratory. For example, there's a terrific scientist named Scott Sternson, who works at the Genelia Farm Research Center, and he is a world expert on how the brain controls eating, appetite. I thought he would write on that. He said, no, I want to write about free will. So I said, you go, Scott.
Now, it's interesting to me, what is it about science, neuroscientists' brain or anybody's brain, that you felt like it was important to have those conversations after a drink or two or a puff or two of, as you say, mildly mind-altering substances? Why do we all need sometimes, I guess, to loosen up in that way when it comes to brain function and how we think?
Well, I think it's, as you say, it's something that's true for everyone, but I think it's particularly true for scientists. In other words, scientists are trained to be meticulous when they speak and to really not talk very much about those things that they believe but cannot prove. And there's a whole category of interesting discussions that you have to prod scientists to get to because they're playing it close to the vest. They're being very careful. They've been trained to be meticulous. And so, a puff or a sip can get over that and get us to some conversations that are perhaps a little more wide-ranging.
Right. And we won't talk about those folks who make a conscious decision not to ever have a puff or a sip and what where they end up creatively and stuff. And we at least will suggest they not worry about staring at the color blue. We know that that's not going to work. You make the comment that it is not trivial that the fact that our brains are not designed optimally. We have a suboptimal design when it comes to our brains because this influences the fact that it's suboptimal. It's not as good as it could be, right? And that influences just this wide range of what we experience as human beings.
Well, so the fact that the brain evolved and that evolution is not an optimal process, it's just a series of flukes and entrapments, is crucial. If you're a designer of a car, in certain years you may have an incremental improvement, but every once in a while you get to wipe the slate clean and start with a completely new design. Evolution never gets to wipe the slate clean. The neurons in our brain are incremental alterations of a design that first appeared in jellyfish-like animals 600 million years ago. And the fact that we have never been able to completely redesign the neuron has made for incredible things. It's made for our human mating system. It's made for love. It's made for our long childhoods. It reaches so deeply into our human experience that it's hard to even find anything that isn't in our experience, that isn't ultimately tied to our evolutionary history.
Yeah, and that evolution is fascinating. You make the observation that death in childbirth, for example, is virtually unheard of in any other mammals, but it's, of course, somewhat commonplace, even now, in modern times, in human beings. And human beings, we're the only ones who can't survive without a parent after 8 years.
That's right, and these things are related. So a human is born with a brain that's about 400 cubic centimeters in volume, and by comparison, that's about the size of an adult chimp. And the adult brain is about 1,200 cc's in volume. And as we know, that 400 cc infant brain barely makes its way through the birth canal. It's a real problem. And you might say, well, why didn't we just evolve for women to have bigger birth canals? And the problem is that then upright walking and the shape of the pelvis become impacted. So you're between a rock and a hard place, so to speak. Then you're born with a 400 cc brain and you need a 1,200 cc brain to be clever us. And how do you get there? Well, it's a very long process of sculpting. The incredibly complex wiring diagram of the brain is so complicated, it can't all be hardwired into our DNA. It has to be wired up from our experience in the world. And that experience in the world for us is very long. We have these very, very, very long childhoods. The there's no other animal where a five-year-old can't make its way in the world independently other than a human. And brain development isn't really complete until around age 20.
And, of course, there are many who work on this program who would say that there's some evidence that brain development is still very incomplete, even in your 60s. But that's a different story. We'll talk a little bit more about the social cultural influences and the genetic neuron chromosomal hormonal influences when we come back. David Linden, he's a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and the editor of a new book called Think Tank, a collection of essays about our brains by 40 neuroscientists. It's a great read. We'll have more with David when we come back. Midday at WYPR.org. That's our email, our Twitter handle at Midday WYPR. We are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page, and if you want to give us a call and have actual human conversation, imagine that, 410-662-8780. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. By the way, coming up on the program tomorrow, former Democratic National Committee Chair Donna Brazile joins me for the next installment in our occasional series about political engagement. Early voting in the Maryland primaries starts in less than a month on June 14th. The election is June 26th. Donna Brazile is the author of Hacks, the inside story of the break-ins and breakdowns that put Donald Trump in the White House. The DNC is suing the Russian government, WikiLeaks, various Russian hackers, and members of the Trump campaign. We'll hear her story about how Russian interference in the 2016 elections affected the work of the DNC and how it influenced the outcome of the election. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, David Linden is my guest. He's a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and the editor of Think Tank, a compilation of essays about our brains and how they inform our experiences as human beings. You are welcome to join our conversation, 410-662-8780, to send us an email. It's midday at WYPR.org. To find us on Twitter, it's at Midday WYPR. If you want to follow me on Twitter, that'd be great. It's at Tom Hall WYPR, and we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. So, David, let me talk to you about a few of these essays, which I just found really fascinating. One is about the so-called teenage brain, right? And it's called Your 12-Year-Old Isn't Just Sprouting New Hair, but is Also Forming and Being Formed by New Neural Connections. This is by Linda Wilbrecht. We have assumptions about the teenage brain, and Dr. Wilbrecht is saying maybe we should reconsider what those assumptions are.
Well, right. We have the assumptions about the teenage brain that it is uncontrolled, pure id, utterly novelty-seeking, unconstrained, poor decision-making, poor planning. And while it's not as if those things aren't entirely untrue, and that is the frontal cortex, which is mostly the seat of those functions, is still developing. It isn't entirely formed in teenagers. I think Linda's point is that because the brain is still developing in the teenage years, it's crucial to not limit your teenager's experience in the world, but to let their brain be formed by as wide a range of safe experiences as is possible.
That's really kind of interesting because, I mean, she's basically saying if we think of them as sort of lacking a frontal lobe and they're just prone to trouble, we think about just protecting them.
That's right.
But she's suggesting we should really change that orientation and say, you know, let's get them out there because they are ripe for having these new experiences.
That's right. And this early period of life in teenage times and even before, there is a drive for new experience. We need experience to wire up the brain in the way that is useful. And there are critical periods for experience. So you probably know that today, if as someone who has never heard a lot of French or a lot of Chinese, if I went to learn French or learn Chinese, I would not, no matter how good I was at languages or how hard I worked, be able to speak with a perfect accent. And that's because the auditory parts of my brain got sculpted by sounds in the language that I heard. And now I can't even hear the subtle differences in proper Chinese pronunciation or proper French pronunciation that would then allow me to reproduce them properly myself. That's one example of a whole number of critical periods of when the sensory systems in our brain are being sculpted by experience that continues through the teenage years.
But there's, of course, social there's a social dimension to how all of us develop, right? So there's what's going on in our brains, but then there's this societal stuff that happens as well. I mean, how do you parse them out? Like when I think about teenagers, I'm going to talk to a guy in a couple of weeks who's written a book called Hitmakers. His name is Derek McConnell, I think. And it's about what makes things popular, why mm-hmm. certain people are popular, certain products are popular, certain songs are popular. And one of the things he says about teenagers is that in the 19th century, when we had an agrarian society, most teenagers did not go to high school. But once this became, our society became a more industrialized society, we all of a sudden had these high schools, and so teenagers were put together in this social situation outside the view of the older generation, their parents. So it's a very different experience being in a class with a bunch of other teenagers as opposed to being next to your father on the assembly line or in the field working in the farm. So there are these cultural things. How do you parse the prevalence or the importance of one over the other?
Well, I think the thing to realize is that in the end, there isn't any kind of problem between the biology and the experience. Experience changes the brain. When psychotherapy works, when talk therapy works, it works because it changes the brain. Your social experience in the world that forms you as an individual does so because it physically changes the connection pattern, the strength of connections, and the activity of neurons in your brain. These things are ultimately intertwined and ultimately compatible. And as you point out, we are deeply culturally influenced. And certain things we're born with and in terms of what we like, and certain things are culturally formed. So, for example, we seem to be born with a preference for facial features that are symmetrical. That seems to be broadly cross-cultural and cross-eras, but the body mass index of a person that we find most attractive has changed enormously cross-culturally. When most people didn't get enough to eat and it was a mark of status to have a few extra pounds, then that was considered the most beautiful thing you could be. And now in the United States, that's not considered the most beautiful thing to be for cultural reasons. That's not because people's brains have changed. It's because culture has changed.
David Linden is the editor of a book called Think Tank, 40 Neuroscientists Explore the Biological Roots of Human Experience. Our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And to find us on Twitter, @MiddayWYPR. And we are, again, streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. So when we talk about life experiences, there's a scientist named Julie Cower who wrote an essay called Life Experiences and Addictive Drugs Change Your Brain in Similar Ways. That was a little depressing. I mean, so addictive drugs and just going through, you know, bumbling through life can have the same effect on your brain?
Well, yes, at a couple of different levels. Basically, when you take a drug that artificially activates your brain's reward system, whether it's alcohol or nicotine or heroin or amphetamine, this produces learning-like changes in your brain. And you associate everything that's happening with you at the time with that pleasurable sensation. It's a very simple kind of associative learning, like we know from Pavlov's dog. For example. And that's why if you're an addict trying to stay clean, it's very hard to be around those stimuli that you used to associate with drug use, whether it's certain people or music or smells or places. They are more likely to trigger relapse because that connection has been super learned by the use of pleasurable drugs.
And she says that drugs of abuse target very specific molecules. I mean, it goes right to to specific places. I guess it doesn't affect some molecules, and it really affects other molecules, and they can alter brain function for long times after exposure.
That's absolutely right. And you know, what's challenging, and I think what anyone who's battling addiction and trying to stay clean knows, is that once your addiction has progressed to a certain level and you get clean, your brain has changed forever. In other words, you will
always... So it doesn't change back.
It doesn't change back. All the indications from both human and animal studies is that addiction changes your brain forever, and you will always struggle more. You will always have more cravings, and should you relapse and fall off the wagon, the pleasure rush you will get from that first hit is higher than from someone just trying it for the first time. So the brain makes it hard.
Yeah, it does. There's also a really interesting essay by a scientist named Adrian Haith called Almost Everything You Do Is a Habit. And so we are, you know, you hear the term, we are creatures of habit, and boy, are we ever.
Are we ever, and the truth is, if we weren't creatures of habit, life would be very tedious. In other words, if I had to think about the motor plan for unlocking my car, getting in and putting on the seatbelt, and driving to work step by step like a computer program, that would take all my attention. I probably wouldn't be able to listen to WYPR on my way to work
and attend to it
because I would be so utterly engaged with the action of that driving. It's only when these things become automatic that you can then divert your attention to other things.
And I was interested in this essay, was talked about the distinction between habit and goal-directed behavior. And there is even a difference, evidently, between men and women when it comes to behavior that is goal-directed versus behavior that they're just used to doing all the time.
Well, that's right. So you can have a common goal but have many different ways to get there. But a habit is something that is stereotyped, that you not just get to the same goal every time, but you get to it in the very same way.
So this goal-directed stuff has to do with whether or not your actions adapt if your goals change. I was interested in this because just a couple of weeks ago, my wife, whom I admire and respect in every way possible, she's a marathoner, and she ran her 30th marathon and her 10th Boston marathon in Boston, Massachusetts, on one of the most miserable days ever for a marathon. It's 40 degrees, it's raining, it's windy, it was terrible. And at the end of the race, it turns out that more men dropped out of the race, and hundreds of people, I think it's like 1,500 people, started and couldn't finish it. More men dropped out than women, and it was because, according to an article in the New York Times, that women were more adept at changing their goals, understanding this is not going to be my fastest marathon, I've just got to get through this, whereas the men were trying to plug through and do it in the way they were habitually used to running marathons. They were trying to run the speed they were used to running. So does that coincide with the findings of Dr. Haith in this essay?
I think it does. And I think another thing that's reasonable to hypothesize in this, and that is all reproductive age women have to contend with cyclical biology. And so the notion that your body and your mind aren't always the same is something that women in that period of life deal with. Likewise, pregnancy is an enormous alteration that women have to deal with. So one could say that biologically, it's not unlikely that women are better equipped to deal with changes in circumstance than men are from those biological roots.
That's right. You heard it from the doctor. Ben, up in the newsroom, he's our intern. He writes in an email, have you heard the thing that has gone viral where people listen and some hear one name and some hear something completely different? Can you explain this in terms of the brain?
Well, I think I should explain what it is first. So many people may remember something that went around the internet a few years ago about a dress that either looked sort of silver or blue, and people argued about it. The thing you hear right now is a sound file, and some people hear it saying Laurel, Laurel, like the name, and other hear people hear Yanny, Yanny.
And you would think that those are pretty far apart.
Well, but when you actually break down the analysis of the sound signal, they're not that far apart. They share sort of energy envelopes and overtones. And I don't think I've heard the final word on this, but I saw some speech scientists on Twitter saying that if your high-frequency sound perception is fully intact, that you're more likely to hear Yanny, and if it's compromised, you're more likely to hear Laurel. But I can't evaluate. I am just repeating something that I read on the internet. I cannot actually attest to that myself.
And we know everything on the internet.
That's
it's
right.
True.
It's gotta be.
You got to believe everything because it's on the internet. Bobby in Baltimore sends an email: to help with my anxiety and depression, my therapist often suggests focusing on positive thoughts, behaviors, and feelings. So he says that if you can get 2 out of 3, right? Thoughts, behaviors, and feelings. If you get 2 out of 3, you're on a good track. This sometimes works for me. What's going on in the brain here?
Well, that's a great question. And the short answer is we don't entirely know. But what we do know is that there is an interplay between our sense of our own body and our emotional state. And so this underlies why when you adopt a strong posture, you mentally feel a little stronger and more resolute. It identifies when people start to force a smile, they can actually make themselves feel a little better. And we don't entirely understand the neurobiological basis of this, but we know that areas in our perception regions of our brain are modulated by context and emotion, and they feed back into those regions. So, you know, when you're trying to stay positive and reduce anxiety, exercise is a good thing, positive thinking is a good thing, getting yourself used to small doses of anxiety and attending and realizing that things are okay are a good thing. Biofeedback to be aware of your heart rate can be a good thing. All of these things can help.
All right. The scientific theory known as fake it till you make it. That's right.
More or less.
Mind reading. There's one about mind reading. It's called Mind Reading Emerged at Least Twice in the Course of Evolution. This is by a scientist named Gull Dolan. Turns out octopuses are just as good at mind reading as humans are, and maybe neither of us are very good at it.
Well, it turns out to be a particular type of octopus that Dr. Dolan studied. And Dr. Dolan, I should mention, is here in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins University. And so there are most octopuses are very asocial, but there is one particular species of octopus that we believe has a theory of mind because it can reach its tentacle around and sort of tap prey on the back in order to get that prey to run into all the rest of the tentacles where it can be engulfed and eaten. And so when we break that down, for the octopus to realize that that's a good strategy, the octopus has to have the notion that the prey is going to run from the tap on its back.
Can read the mind of the prey.
That's right.
Yeah, but of course we do a little mind reading all of the time. I mean, when someone comes up to us in a maybe like a harried state or something and is about to speak, we can sort of guess that there's something wrong going on, or we could intuit that the person is very happy or a person is very sad. I mean, is that considered mind reading, or is that just observational?
Well, I think these things go together. In other words, the ability to imagine the mental state of another person, we can do that from knowing circumstances. And we're exquisitely good at reading facial expression and tone of voice and body language. And the reason that we are is because we've lived in small social groups of 30, 40, 50 people through most of our hominin evolution. And in those times, reading those social cues was key to thriving and surviving and mating and getting your genes into the next generation. And that's why we don't struggle to read the nuances of vocal tone.
David Linden is a neuroscientist at Johns Hopkins. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org and our Twitter handle at @MiddayWYPR. The book is called Think Tank. So, David, every time you come over here, we talk about sex, at least a little bit, right?
So
one of your essays here is human sexual orientation is strongly influenced by biological factors. So these terms you write that we use, heterosexual, homosexual, bisexual, you say they're actually pretty crude measures and metrics.
Well, they are crude. And I think societally we're realizing this more and more as time goes on. People, you know, don't like labels or have more exotic labels. So they're crude because not everyone will maintain one of these straight, gay, bi orientations through their life. Someone may say, well, I'm interested in the idea of sexual activity in this way, but I may not actually do it. We know that sexual orientation behavior is somewhat more changeable in women on average than it is in men. Nonetheless, even though these labels are crude, they're at least moderately useful, particularly in adults. They're more changeable early in life, but usually by the time you're 30, saying that someone is straight or gay or bi is going to capture, if not all, of the aspects of one's sexual behavior, certainly a reasonable one that's worthwhile talking about.
And a transgender person hearing you say that might think what?
Well, but transgender really, you know, is a separate issue. Right?
Right.
In other
because
words,
you can still have an orientation that is hetero or
homo. Who you feel
homo.
You are and who you want to be with sexually or romantically are independent things. Almost no one, when they transition, changes their sexual orientation at the same moment.
Right.
Yeah.
So a lot of people do confuse that. So I'm glad that you made that point. We have time for one quick email. It may not be super quick. It's a very erudite question from Eric, who says, if a suboptimal brain is capable of knowing itself as suboptimal, as your comments and analysis presuppose, then that suboptimal brain is capable of criticizing and correcting itself. So how is that possible? Is that the kind of self-guided evolution or just the usual biological process?
Well, I think the thing to keep in mind here is that biological evolution is an independent thing and parallel to cultural knowledge. So we can accumulate through introspection and through art and through science all kinds of understanding about what it is to be human, but we don't necessarily then transmit that understanding genetically to our offspring. So there is no contradiction between the idea that our brains, our evolved brains, are suboptimal and the idea that we can understand ourselves better through inquiry and experimentation and creativity.
That will be the last word. David Linden, it's always fun talking to you, and this is another really terrific gem of a book. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
David Linden's latest book, it's called Think Tank, 40 Neuroscientists Explore the Biological Roots of Human Experience. David Linden and a few of the book's contributors will hold a panel discussion about the book tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine Department of Neuroscience, and you can also catch David Linden at Greedy Reads in Fells Point on June 4th at 7 o'clock. We've got links to all the details on our website, wypr.org/midday. Coming up after a break, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews the final show of the season at Baltimore Center Stage. It's a premiere of a new musical called Soul, the Stax Musical. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us.
Gosh, it would be awful pleasing to reason out the reason for things I can't explain. Then perhaps I'll deserve you and be even worthy of you if I only had a brain.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.